From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Tuesday's firing of FBI Director James Comey by President Trump led to calls by Democrats and much of the U.S. media for the appointment of a special prosecutor, with the New York Times comparing it to Watergate. For more on that, we spoke with Peter Lavelle, the host of RT's Crosstalk, via Skype from Moscow, Wednesday.
You know, looking at partisan politics in the United States from afar, it's almost like a spectator sport. you can look at all kinds of sports on television, you know, with all 501 or 1,000 channels, and one of those channels is American politics. And you, from where I sit, you just kind of get a big basket of popcorn and watch who's doing what to whom. It's better than House of Cards by far. The opponents of Trump are gravitating to, and it was obvious as soon as the news broke, is that, you know, they're going to press harder on this Russiagate. And from the perspective of Moscow, people looking in on this, is that if there was something there that started in July of last year, well, can we see just a little bit of it? I mean, look at all of the television time, radio time, print that has just been, you know, overwhelmingly focused on this issue. And we still, as you and I speak, we don't have one shred of evidence other than confidence. Confidence means we don't know, okay? Yeah. And then I watched this congressional committee a few days ago about Michael Flynn. No, I'm no friend of Michael Flynn and his ideas. But to watch someone destroyed like that in public, in Congress, he did this, but we can't tell you. We can't tell you what he did, but what he did was really bad. Really? And asked repeatedly, what did he do? And we still don't know what that is. And being no friend of Michael Flynn, when I was watching that, I actually came across it live, believe it or not. Mm. My thought was, they can do this to anyone now.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you can't defend yourself. No evidence is presented. And then you're put on trial. You're sentenced and essentially executed. And now if he says, I want immunity, see? He's guilty, as we said. I mean, this is McCarthyism of the worst kind. And what I thought was really troubling is watching the Republican Party roll over. And I am no Republican, okay?
Right.
They rolled right with the Democrats. So from Moscow's perspective, if there's something there, then show it. Or stop talking about it. Because it's almost, it's to the point of just, it's mindlessness. I mean, I would like to know what, if there's anything to these allegations, but I've seen these reports come out. We've seen what James Clapper said on live television on NBC. I think it was March 5th. He said, it was asked repeatedly, is there any evidence of Russian collusion with the Trump campaign? No, there is none. He said that. He said it twice.
That's right.
Then he said, Senator Feinstein. Much to the chagrin of Wolf Blitzer on the counterfeit network news station, he asked her directly, have you seen any evidence as you were visiting Arlington, visiting the CIA? And she said, no, we haven't, which he turned instantly red and then cut to a break. I wonder why. Okay.
It was cute. I mean, it was cute day before yesterday when Comey was under a direct examination by Senator Al Franken. That's funny to me all by itself, Senator SNL. But where Franken said, well, we know that these 17 agencies all agreed. And Clapper says, well, no, actually, it was only three.
And it was the NSA that had the least confidence of them all in the one that would be in a position to say with any kind of forceful conclusions would be the NSA, and they're the ones that had the least confidence.
That's right. And it was funny watching as Franken kept trying to make factual assertions And these are like foundational to the myth out there of, you know, this whole Russiagate thing. Each factual assertion that he made, Clapper said, actually, no. And at the end of it, it was summed up by Franken as if he had said yes to all of those things. But this took place in plain view, that this whole part of the myth had been exploded. There weren't 17 intel agencies that had investigated and reached a common assessment. In fact, there were only three that were involved at all, and only one that was in a position to know anything, and it's the most skeptical out of the group cited.
You know, Don, we have to make sure our listeners understand. I don't know what happened. I don't know if there was real Russian meddling in the American election. You know, and if I put parentheses right now, we know the United States is involved in elections all over the world all of the time. I've been involved in the Democratic elections 80 separate different times, not including coups. Okay,
right.
Okay. Close parenthesis. Okay, if Russia was involved, and I'm sure the United States should be worried about that. But let's give the evidence so we can draw conclusions. This is my issue. My issue is the lack of evidence. And then once we have some kind of evidence, and you can make some kind of assessment. But this is just used as a stick to keep beating down on an election that was months ago, after the inauguration of a president months ago. We've got to move on. And as soon as Comey was fired, I knew instantly, now they're going to be gravitating again on this issue, which is absolutely going nowhere. Right. They need to say something, prove something, and move on. Or else what they're doing is they're collapsing the political system in the United States. The media is collapsing itself. I mean, this is like a circular firing squad. Yeah. And again, from where I sit far away, you know, there's nothing you can do to stop it. I mean, this is just going into some kind of derangement syndrome. I've never seen it in my life.
It is pretty wild to observe. The recent firing, yesterday's firing, we're talking Wednesday morning, is just one step. We've had resignations and Flynn, you mentioned, for example, being driven out. And, you know, Trump came in particularly with a foreign policy that was a dissident foreign policy from the consensus that had been reached for 30 years or better. That was the point. I mean, the fact of Russia being at the focal point here, the foreign policy heresy expressed by Trump during the campaign has really been the focal point of the attacks on his administration. And we've been seeing some backpedaling here, apparent backpedaling, but some progress in other areas. And then objective conditions like what just happened in South Korea, sort of spinning events on their own, where there's, regardless of what the United States would like to do with North Korea, for example, South Korea just elected a president that wants to talk and maybe make peace and get rid of the Thads. All of these moving parts are leading somewhere. Before the election, it looked like if Clinton were elected, we would be headed towards some real severe confrontation between the U.S. and Russia and China. Do you see any of that being mitigated, or is it in flux? Or, you know, what are people talking about there about all of that?
I think, Don, you and I are victim of something that everyone that is involved in the media is affected by, and it's called the news cycle. And maybe, and I'm kind of agreeing with you, maybe we're being overwhelmed by the news cycle. Maybe there is a much deeper plan that this administration has. I think that, look at the firing, the timing of Comey. Okay, you have the former head of the NSA, Clapper. He came out on television, on NBC, saying that there is no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Okay, we have also Clapper and Yates speaking in front of Congress. Even though it was a circus, no substance came out. They didn't give any evidence of any kind of connection. We have no idea what Mr. Flynn did. I mean, will we ever know what he did?
Right.
And
right.
I have to point out to our listeners, too, is that when he was captured on under surveillance talking to the Russian ambassador, one kind of commonsensical thing that is never talked about is that The Russians have a recording of that conversation, and so does the NSA. So where's the blackmail element if both sides know, have the same information? This what Yates was saying is that it opened him up to potential blackmail. That's utter nonsense. I mean, these people need to grow up, okay? If both sides have exactly the same information, it is of no blackmail information whatsoever.
Right.
So right. Further to answer your question, maybe there is. I mean, I am to the nth degree an anti-war person, okay? And you know, and my viewers at Crosstalk know that when Trump was flipping on foreign policy and embracing the neocon mantra, of course I was upset and of course I was disillusioned. But maybe for the first time in a long time, I'm going to give him more of a benefit of doubt. Maybe there is some kind of larger plan in play. But this greater embrace of Saudi Arabia, I find very, very disturbing. Obviously, the president of the United States does not know the nuances of the Israeli-Palestine conflict. That's very important, as an important element of American foreign policy, for the worse, I would say, in the Middle East.
Sure.
So there are very troubling things. Maybe, you know, he needs to get people on board, or at least not so hostile for him, to be able to start moving forward. Now, that's not a bad game plan, okay? But, you know, bombing Syria illegally under international law, and then blaming the regime of Assad in Syria for a chemical weapons attack, which is overwhelmingly been disproved if you want to do your homework. So, you know, I guess it's really, I'm hoping maybe that there's a deeper plan here. But going back to Comey, the timing of it is perfect. All of the ticks in the box were signed off. I mean, and Trump even said in his cover letter, firing Comey, which really surprised me, and I think everybody else, is that, you know, you've said three times that I was not under an investigation for any kind of involvement with the Russians. I mean, that's kind of an odd thing to do, to put into somebody's letter that you're firing, all right? So I think that Steve Bannon and others said, look, I mean, you know, all the public record of these officials that are not either our enemies or are connected to the former administration and the deep state. I mean, they pretty much signed off on this. I mean, this is evidence for our case. So we'll see where it goes. Comey, he was just erratic in the end. Erratic. I for a FBI director to be speaking like he was speaking, it was all about Mr. Comey in the end, which you and I know. You know, you and I have the gray hair. Now, J. Edgar Hoover never acted that way.
That's right.
I mean, no FBI director grandstanded like that. Okay? And, you know, I think the way he handled the Hillary Clinton email things was appalling. I don't, maybe like many of our listeners, I watched live his press conference, you know, listing all of the illegal acts, of Hillary Clinton with her private server. And then he says, they're not going to prosecute. You know, first of all, I was appalled by that. Second of all, the director of the FBI doesn't decide if someone is prosecuted. The FBI, what's the I stand for in FBI? Investigation.
That's right.
It wasn't his call to do that. Yep. So he went beyond the bounds of his position. And I think that the Trump people said, look, this guy, he's in the chain of command. Of course, you know, he's supposed to be independent nominally. Okay. But, you know, the president, you have the attorney general and you have the FBI, and the attorney general and the FBI the director serves at the pleasure of the president of the United States. So anybody that says on the left or in the media that, you know, Trump is abusing his power, he's absolutely not. You may not agree with the decision, but it was perfectly in his bounds to do such a thing. So, you know, there's a lot of white noise out there, but it doesn't create any heat.
You know, I want to get to what It's been happening in Russia the last few days, the Victory Day celebrations, and more importantly, the phenomenon around the the popularity of that and the participation in it and the meaning of it to people there. But I want to touch this last point. You mentioned Comey's press conference back then, and to me, it seemed that it was obviously contrived by pro-Clinton people as a damage control move, because those revelations were coming out and it was an attempt for, to minimize the significance of those things with a declaration from the head of the FBI saying, we don't consider that criminal.
Yeah, but the way he did it, it didn't work. Simply didn't work, because what the impression is, I think objectively speaking, is that some people are above the law. And that's what it looked like. And I think he did it very badly. If that was the gambit, it didn't work.
Right.
And then that was the gambit, going back, diving back in the deep end, saying, I'm reopening the investigation. Right. And then, I'm satisfied a few days later. I mean, that is just gross interference in the political process here. Though at the same time, I don't think that quote-unquote Russiagate, Russia meddling, Hillary Clinton's emails, I don't think that really affected voters very much. It was great consumption for the media. The media just talks to itself, and it does is pat itself on the back.
Right.
And that's why they got the election so wrong, because they didn't listen to the American people. I mean, I've talked to a countless number of people over the last few months, and most of them independently telling me that most people made up their mind in August to who they were going to vote for. Okay. And I think it was the deplorables comment that really did it for a lot of people across the country.
Yeah.
All this other stuff is kind of fluff. I mean, if you live inside the Beltway, this is, your bread and butter. This is what you live on. But when you go outside the Beltway, the concerns, I really don't think people are really worried about Vladimir Putin reading the DNC's emails, okay? I mean, because everybody apparently read all of those emails.
That's right. Everybody reads everybody's emails.
The door was open, okay?
Right.
I think everybody was, okay? Kids from Moldova were probably reading it for all we know, okay? I mean, if you just step back and apply a little bit of logic and common sense, you see it very differently.
So, okay, this, the whole Victory Day celebration, which of course commemorates the victory over fascism in 1945, and this is the Soviet victory, and we are looking at this happening, the sort of the revival of it in the context of the increased hostility by the United States and some European countries towards Russia, almost in a response, as Russia's demonized in the West, the pride in Russia by Russians is being used as an organizing principle, and apparently very successfully.
Yeah, I think that the anti-Russian narrative that we've seen intensely since the illegal overthrow of the government in Kiev in February 2014, it's only accelerated since then. But most of Russians are, I would say, immune to it. Yeah, the West doesn't like us. Yeah, that's nothing particularly new. And so what we saw over the last couple of years with this immortal brigade, which people get pictures of their descendants that had or their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents that fought during the Great Patriotic War, as it's called here. And it's been going on for a couple of years now, and we have the May Day parade, and we have the military display and all that, and that's pretty common fare, okay? But this immortal battalion is something really new, and it's people participating. The May Day parade is for it's a very select group of people who get in there because of security reasons. And everyone can watch it on TV, but you can get a placard of your ancestor that fought in the truly most defining moment in modern Russian history. And you can go down your own city street with your neighbors and your friends, and you see pictures of their relatives. And it is such an amazing, it's very emotional, Don. It's very emotional because for that moment, all of these differences that people have among themselves. And of course, Russians have differences among themselves like any other population in the world. But for that moment, you know, that is such a unifying moment around such a positive thing, an amazingly positive thing. It is not at anyone's expense, no one's expense. And next door in Ukraine, they created what I would say proto-fascist regime in Kiev. They came up with something with the mortal battalion, meaning people that did duplicate what Russians were doing in Russia. The Ukrainians that tried to do it, they would be assaulted with eggs and tomatoes, and hopefully not rocks. Okay, so they want to completely demean that moment that means is so cherished among the people of Russia. And, you know, Russia is more than just Russians. There's a lot of other people here, too.
Hey, let's talk about that history, which involved them. I mean, what we're talking about is the invasion by the fascist countries, particularly Germany, of the USSR and, you know, towards the beginning of World War II. And the killing, essentially, of tens of millions of people in the USSR, the siege of Leningrad and a number of Russian and Soviet cities, and a people's war that fought them off, basically.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. You know, it's the peoples of the Soviet Union that won the war in spite of Stalin, okay? In spite of his very, very bad decision-making just prior to and the first 6 weeks of the war after the invasion on June 22nd, 1941, that cost the Soviet Union and the peoples of the Soviet Union greatly. And I just mentioned the case of Ukraine. Over a million Red Army troops died liberating Ukraine from the Nazis. Let that sink in with the people that don't think that Russia is Russia shouldn't be given the credit that's due. I mean, let's be frank. When the surrender on May 8th, because of the time change, it was already May 9th in Moscow, but it was still May 8th in Germany. And the war was won because of the sacrifice of the peoples of the Soviet Union. I do not diminish the role of the Western Allies, but by the time of the Normandy landing in June 1944, that was well past the Battle of Kursk. And that was the ultimate turning point. The wave had changed. The Nazis never could assemble another assault against the Soviet Union. They were retreating very much so by the time of the landing in Normandy. So, that's one of the things that Russians take great pride in, because they did it essentially alone at a cost that is, it's just hard to imagine that kind of loss of life. And that's why, and I've said on your program before, there's no town, there's no city, there's no place you can go in Russia where you're not reminded of the sacrifice of the Second World War almost on a minute-to-minute basis. I'm serious. The names of streets, the statues, commemorative symbols that are on every public building. It's living history. And then we see that Western powers again are hostile to today's Russia. It's easy two dots to connect, and it's something the West just doesn't get, because I've lived in Russia for 18 years, and the Russians squabble among themselves like nobody's business. I mean it. But when push comes to shove, they get united, and there's solidarity, and it's palatable. You feel it. You see it. And that's what I saw during this procession of the Immortal Brigade. It was very, very moving.
And I'm just looking forward at we've got a meeting. Is it today? Lavrov is meeting with Tillerson today, Wednesday, in Washington. And I guess that a meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin is being set. Do you see any possibilities of a a real material change in the, if not the rhetoric, in the operating relationship between the two countries?
Well, I think your question actually is two parts, two levels to it. Yes, I think operationally it's already happening, but on a public display of that kind of operational coordination, I don't think we're going to see it. Last week, there were some, it was confidential and private, so I'm not going to name any names, but former ambassadors, American ambassadors to Russia, and a number of academics met informally with some of their counterparts here in Moscow. And I was very pleased to learn some of the details after they convened and then broke up their meeting. It lasted a couple of days. And the word that was used the most often was toxic, the toxic public relations problem that U.S.-Russia relations have. And they're very pessimistic they're going to be able to get out of this cul-de-sac. But it doesn't mean there can't be operational contact. It'll just have to be a lot more under the radar, working on possibly on some kind of deal in Syria. I'm not overly confident about that, but I think there's beginning to talk again after that disastrous relationship Lavrov had with Kerry. So I think, you know, that there's going to be there has to be some more operational contact, but to get out of this Russiagate, this pure invention of the media and the Democratic Party trying to explain their defeat in the last year's election. And I think that's going to stay with us, particularly with the firing of Comey. That's going to be intensified, at least for the next few news cycles. But I think there's growing common sense, and I have my fingers crossed, hoping that the administration is finally getting itself together and going to start having much more of a sober view of the world. And I just hope Donald Trump doesn't lob a few more missiles just to get some public opinion points, because that really, really irritated me, and it really irritated a lot of people that had hope for Donald Trump in foreign policy, at least. So, again, let's be cautious here. But one thing is irrefutable, Don, and our listeners have to understand this, is that the United States and Russia have to have some kind of relationship. We don't know what it's going to be, but they do.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. If we're going to look forward, finally, for markers of an actual change in the operational relationship, you mentioned Syria. Are there any other areas we should be looking at for clues?
Possibly North Korea. I think that, again, the inexperience of the national security team and I think the new military leaders that Trump has put in place, I think, you know, people are flexing their muscles a little bit too much. They wanted to see if they work, I guess. And North Korea could be one there, too. I think the Chinese, very quietly, as they usually do behind the scenes, made it very clear to the Trump people what you're thinking and what you're talking about out loud about North Korea is extremely unhelpful. And it would be wise to stop doing it. And then when we have the new president coming to power in South Korea, that should be another sobering moment, that this problem with North Korea is manageable and it can be resolved, but there has to be very fresh eyes put on it. And I think that's what China would like to see the United States do, is to lead in that, because China, in its ways, behind the scenes, is managing its neighbor, North Korea. And that's a totally different topic for us to talk about, because it's really complex and really deep. I'm going to be looking at really how Europe is going to have to get itself in line to deal with the United States, because we have Macron becoming president of France, some cyborg type character. I mean, it's really unbelievable. We have Brexit and all that, and the Europeans are going to have to start coalescing and how they're going to have to deal with the United States on a much more realistic level. I mean, Merkel's visit here to Moscow was a disaster. It really was. And you know what, Don? Europe needs to have a relationship with Russia. It needs it very much so. And Russia wants that. And it's really incumbent upon not changing Russian behavior, as we always hear. It's really about how the U.S. and its allies are going to have to get their ducks lined up and start learning to think about how to be more constructive. Because what we saw at the very end of the Obama administration was an intentional plan to destroy everything as the new president was coming into office. It was just to burn everything to the ground. It was, I think, one of the most despicable things an outgoing president has ever done in history. I've never seen any president do that before, what Obama did, intentionally creating roadblocks and problems and setting out a minefield of problems for him. And that's the first few months that Trump has had to deal with that.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.